Hello and welcome to There's No Business Like, a podcast where friends and industry colleagues explore topics and interview leaders in our industry of professional theatrical touring.
Welcome back, everyone, to this week's episode. My name is Kevin Maynard. I'm the executive director of Quad City Arts. And as always, I am joined here with my friends, Josh.
Josh Benson from Marion, Illinois at the Marion Cultural and Civic Center.
Danielle.
Oh, hey, it's Danielle Van Hook from the Alden in McLean, Virginia.
Brian.
Hi, everybody. Brian Zellmer from KU Presents in Kutztown, Pennsylvania.
And my co-host for this week, Katie Miller.
Hi, it's Katie with Midland Center for the Arts in Midland, Michigan.
Well, friends, we've got a great interview this week with Joshua Heim, the executive director of the Western Arts Alliance. And to kick things off, Katie has a question for you all.
All right. So related to our episode this week, I am wondering, and this is actually like a two-parter. This is a choose your own adventure question. Ooh. You can either tell us a story about the most unexpected or strangest place you've ever had a business meeting, or a time where you showed up to a business meeting dressed incredibly inappropriately.
This is kind of a combination of both. We were having a production meeting in the bar that was connected to the venue that was producing the show that I was designing for. And it was a design meeting for High School Musical. And I walk into the meeting, and pretty quickly into the meeting, I was asked, how comfortable are you taking your shirt off? And could you take your shirt off really quickly? Without any context behind it, shortly after me taking my shirt off, because I was pretty comfortable with it, they asked me if I could sing or dance. And it turns out that the Rocky and Rocky Horror had just dropped out of the production. They were 2 weeks out from the show, and they desperately needed to find someone who looked muscular that could do the show. And I was much more muscular, much less fat at that point. And so that's how that happened in that meeting. Additionally, for me, with the mural work and everything else, I take a lot of business phone calls, like on the top of the lifts, like 60 feet in the air. And, you know, I mean, it's just kind of a normal thing for me.
When I was at a previous venue, there was an important meeting that I had to do. It was an interview for another job. And there, in my venue, it was a really loud rock concert at the time of the interview. And I panicked because I didn't know where to go at the time of the interview. You know, it was during my lunch break, so it's not like I was, you know, doing it on work hours, but I remembered last, like, few minutes beforehand that there was construction going on the adjoining building next door, and it was still close enough to get the Wi-Fi so I can be on the Zoom call. And so I rode the elevator up to the locked door and kind of like snuck into this construction area where it happened to be lunchtime, so everybody was gone, and I did the interview there before anyone came back in like this active construction zone.
So real question, did you get the job?
I'm here, aren't I?
They said, that guy's resourceful. Katie, I hope it's okay if I combine your questions a little bit.
Absolutely.
But I was once having a business meeting, and a person in a hazmat suit walked by.
That's why is my question.
Did your
why?
Meeting quickly end after that?
I mean, I still don't think I totally know. But I'm still here.
But she glows now.
Okay, I will say maybe this is a little bit of a strange and pretty inconvenient place to actually just take a business phone call. So one of my former venues, I would have to climb out on the roof for a variety of reasons, including maintenance and changing the letters on the marquee sign. And somebody called me like 6 times in a row. And so I was assuming this was some sort of emergency and I needed to call them back. So while I was out on the roof, you know, called them back. And while I'm having a conversation with whomever was on the end of the line, slipped and almost fell off the roof 30 feet to my death. Ugh. So, but I'm still here. So
I used to work for an elevator escalator company, and in our hometown community, they have a test elevator tower. So where they can, you know, run simulations. But you get to invited to a meeting or a tour inside the tower. And so I got to take a meeting inside the tower, which is really high up, overlooks the Mississippi River. And the boardroom inside there has not been redecorated since the 70s. So it's got some thick shag carpeting and it sways. So you'll be sitting there having a conversation and you can literally feel the building shift underneath you. That was probably the weirdest place or most interesting place I've taken a meeting.
Well, thanks for sharing, friends. I'm glad we're all still here. And I really hope you enjoy this conversation with Joshua Heim.
Hi, friends. I'm Joshua Heim, I'm an arts leader from the Pacific Northwest. I'm a yoga teacher, and I'm an avid outrigger canoe paddler.
Well, Josh, it is so wonderful to have you here with us on There's No Business Like. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. Got Kevin here in the co-hosting seat with me today, so we're really looking forward to having a great conversation.
Thank you for hosting.
So we're going to dive right in. We would love to just learn a little bit more about you. Can you tell us, you know, a little bit about your background and how you got into arts administration and how you ended up where you are today?
I'm currently the executive director of the Western Arts Alliance, which is a membership-based organization headquartered in Portland, Oregon, but serves the Reston region and the provinces. But really, we're a national organization. We run national and international programs. The decade leading into this, I was in government, city and local government. And before that, I was in arts nonprofits, as we all were. All of us got our start there, right? In museums, in advocacy organizations, some social justice organizations that have nothing to do with the arts. And so broadly speaking, that's been my career. I got started, I think like most of us, in the arts. I've been a after school, out of school time arts kid since I was the third grade. I may or may not have been in the world premiere production of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory in Kainalu Elementary School's production, right? That headlined in the school lunch auditorium.
I love that.
Third grade, and ever since then, I've been involved in theater. I went to a high school conservatory. Right. That was sort of, you know, designed to sort of drop us into BFA programs. And by the end of it, realized that I didn't have the talent nor the network nor the honestly the drive to be able to make it as a starving artist. And so What do you do when your entire life's career and trajectory suddenly like goes skidding off the rails? You go to a small liberal arts college and you study cultural anthropology, in which case, really, that's sort of where I was introduced to not just the field of ethnography, but really sort of these conversations about the role that arts plays in society. And in particular for me, because I'm from Hawaii originally, it was sort of the space and the time for me to understand another practice of mine. I used to dance hula, was very involved in conversations that I would say most conservatory kids aren't. And that is conversations about self-determination, conversations about the preservation of language and of a whole people. I'm talking about Native Hawaiians. I am not Native Hawaiian myself, but just being part of the hula community, you know, that's why you practice. And so really from then on, my goal, my whole life's work has really been about how do you use the arts? How do you use the culture to transform society? How do you effectuate change at the same time, right? I mean, I'm a conservatory kid. I was taught the values of virtuosity, of quality. How do we do that in ways that really advance the imagination? So
there is a lot to unpack there.
Sure, let's do it.
So first, I kind of want to take a step back. I mean, we are all, you know, theater nerds here. So I would be curious, just like, one, are you still doing theater? And then two, favorite roles? Do one, two, whatever you want to choose.
Sure, not doing theater anymore. The last time I did theater, I was in, I had a great teacher in high school who got a gig in Seattle, and I was living in Seattle, this is my mid-20s, to do a summer production and for a summer youth program. And so as it happens, right, the assistant director, when one kid decides that, well, he's going to go on the family vacation as opposed to carry out the rest of the four performances,
yep. Oh, no.
The assistant director has to step on stage and play the leading man role. So that's actually the last time I was on stage, but no, I don't do theater anymore. Favorite roles, I would say most challenging roles, Lopakhin, The Cherry Orchard, Oberon, Midsummer Night's Dream.
Wow. Those are some great roles.
Yeah. I can totally see you as Oberon. I love that. Actually, and that's a delicate balance role of like, you got to have the language, but also the fun with it too. That's great.
Mostly because this is something I don't think, I definitely don't know much about. And I know we definitely haven't talked about it on here. Can you talk a little bit about the art of hula? Like, I mean, how you got into it and sort of its cultural significance there.
So like I said, I went to a high school, right? It was a regular high school, most of us. And there was a school of the arts. So it was the school within the school, right? My experience was, I mean, I was on campus until 10 o'clock at night, either in rehearsals or in production. Finally, the school of the arts was integrated into the day program my senior year. And that's when I was able to now actually, you know, participate in regular kid activities. And so hula is one of these things. And so I didn't get started until later. And then in college and summers, you know, when I would come back from home. And hula, it is a dance form. The way that it has been taught to me is that it is a lifestyle, right? When you practice hula, you are, I mean, you're practicing tradition. You're practicing someone's genealogy. You're also taking care, right? So, you know, part of the practice is making your garments, is making your lays. And so you're taught not only how to do that, but you're taught, you know, this is the spot in the mountain where we can go. And this is how you pick so that we don't overpick, right? Like we're actually stewarding this space so that, generations, past you, this resource is still here. So, and I was mentioning earlier about being introduced to the activist side of hula, right? So, you know, I don't know if you know much about what's going on in Hawaii and in most indigenous communities, but, you know, there have been a very long conversation about self-determination, about sovereignty, and hula is at the center of that because they were one of the first, it was one of the first spaces in which Hawaiians could be Hawaiian again. You know, they're coming through a colonial history in which their language and the hula in particular were banned. So in the 70s, when the Native Hawaiian community began to rediscover who they are, it was through hula and paddling, actually, like voyaging and canoe navigation. And so when I say it's a lifestyle, it really is practice in a halau, which is it's a hula school. I've been involved in several halau, and you know, you refer to each other as hula brothers and hula sisters, and you know, it's as much dance as it is taking care of your community.
Wow, I love that.
So how does that philosophy, because like it is a way of life, it's a philosophy of living, how does that inform, or how has it informed your work as an arts administrator? So the cultural anthropology, your background in this, it seems like there is a thread maybe that runs from that training and that experience through what you've been doing, first with nonprofit work, then government work, and now with WA. So am I right?
Sure.
On there?
You know what I think is so fascinating, that we have all these like great master's programs and even like undergrad programs that are about arts administration. Did I set out to have an arts administration career? No, because it wasn't a thing, right? Like there was not a language in the 90s. Maybe there was. I just wasn't hip to it. I didn't go to schools that had programs. And so I would say I came to it. I sort of stumbled upon it. And I stumbled upon it in a role at a museum in Seattle called the Wing Luke Asian Museum. It's a Pan-Asian American museum. It's also community-based. And, you know, what's unique about that, you know, we don't have a curatorial practice. We are facilitators. I was in the exhibitions department. And every project would have its advisory committee. Every project, you know, would be visioned and designed by the community, right? Because it was their opportunity to sort of tell their story in their own words. And we were there as caretakers. And I would say not only from then, I mean, this is, you know, I think part of being involved in the kind of spaces I've been in, that's the way that I approach my work, which is on one hand, as a facilitator, as to me, you know, anyone can be a leader. I think in this moment that we're in, I don't know if we have the room or even the appetite for heroes anymore. I think people want to be in community. I think people want to be part of a leadership conversation, no matter where they are, whether we're talking about within an organization or outside. And here I'm talking as my role, right? I am a leader. Yeah. That's just the position that I'm in right now. But I think to be an arts administrator in any kind of institution, you are a leader, whether or not you carry that title. And for me, you know, equity has always been at the center of my leadership and of my work. And for me, that is doing anti-racist work. And to do anti-racist work is to do healing work, right? Like understanding what is the core wound that this community, that this organization has organized itself around, that is trying to work against. Not the mission statement, not what they say that they're doing, but truly, I think most organizations, if they're interfacing with community in a genuine way, if they are BIPOC-led or, you know, they're dealing with hurt, either institutional or otherwise. And so my approach has been, let's talk about it. Let's really figure out what is it and how do we get beyond it? How do we heal?
Is that the approach to get to the core of that is just through conversation? And are there ways that you're doing that at WA, and are there ways that you have done it at previous organizations?
I've been at WA for a year.
Oh, okay. So
I'm figuring it out.
Yeah.
I will say, you know, there's a lot of similarities between my past work and WA. You know, WA is a membership-based organization, and it is led by its members, right? We have a very active board. We have, I mean, I don't know how many, 16 committees. Mm. And they're all exercising some level of authority, some level of autonomy in all the aspects of the work that we do. And like I had mentioned, I'm, you know, 10 years I'm coming off from city government, county government, in which, right, we talk about arts commissions, we talk about arts councils, which that could be a whole thing. Yes. I had this dream about writing a book just called like The Commission, right? I mean, the stories that we all have you have experience with?
I, because of my job, I am a part of, I think, three of them.
Oh yeah.
In some capacity. And it's, at times it's like an episode of Parks and Rec. And then at other times, like we're doing really great work, but it's so much time.
Yeah. It's so much time.
My first gig was, I was the ED of a theater that was owned by a small city, and no, they didn't know how to run a theater. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting experience.
God bless them.
Yep.
God bless them. I love it. Anyway, we can talk arts commission until we're blue in the face.
Bit,
absolutely. Yeah. But you know, WAA is really similar to, these sort of environments that I've always been in, whether I call them community-based or city government, mm-hmm. in which you have constituents, in which, there really isn't room for a singular vision, because what you're working towards is a common vision. So yes, to answer your question, there are, I think, particular strategies and particular ways of living and working in the world to get at a common vision, and there are ways to snuff it out. Mm. And so mm-hmm. just by nature of, I think, most of the work I've done, I'm much better at conveying a common vision than I am at even a personal vision. Like, don't ask me like, well, my vision about why. It's like, I'll tell you to talk to Tony, who's my board president.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the dynamic of being a leader in an organization that is so invested in the membership, and the membership is in return invested in the organization, what is that like for you as a leader coming out of government, where it's very structured and there's a lot of regulation and that sort of thing, and then moving into membership-based organization where you're invested as a leader, but then the membership is also deeply invested in the organization too? That back and forth has got to be really different.
Yes and no. So going back to the similarities, right? My members at WAA vote on their membership dues. They vote on the slate of board members, much like a small town would. You know, they set policies about who's in and who's out, and they create a culture and institute, right, and policy to enforce that. It is not dissimilar to the way arts policy works within city, county, state government, you know? I think, you know, okay, so where are the differences? In government, you're in it for the long game, right? No one is interested in a 3-year vision, not even a 5-year vision, because at the core of the government enterprise is to ensure the vitality of a community. And that vitality is, you know, is measured in generations. At a nonprofit, right, like, and especially post-COVID, we're just all trying to get to next year.
Truth.
There is a lot of vision. There's a lot of big vision that is, and that, you know, I don't want to say, you know.
So, I mean, this is, and maybe getting a little too in the weeds here, as essentially the mayor of WAA, how do you, in your role there, focus on the equity work and actually do it in an equitable way? How does that work, given that, you know, your constituents are so involved? Like, do you feel like you have the, I don't want to say the power, like that seems like the wrong term, but like, like the means to do that.
And that was the conversation during, I would say, the hiring process.
Yeah.
I can't probably talk too much about that. All to say that it was the board. I mean, you know, I got some really good advice when I was in college, and the advice was, you know, pick your professors, not your major.
Mm.
Right. Which, you know, in everyday terms is pick the people who are invested in your success and who are going to be there for you. You know, don't worry about being credentialed. You know, in my career, I've translated that into pick your boss.
Yeah.
Not the organization, not the department, but pick your boss. As an executive director, who do you get to pick? You get to pick your board.
Yeah.
I was so impressed with the WAA board, because the conversations that we were having during the interview process was precisely this, right? Like, how does an organization with such a long history and such a legacy, who for most of their members, the conference is the organization. Mm-hmm. They're asking questions about how do we get beyond the conference? How do we lean into this equity work, given that we are a membership organization? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, those are really interesting questions.
Yes.
I can work with that. And I can work with these people. The staff is also amazing. And so it was sort of already built up about that. And we're in a strategic planning process. And so we're actively addressing those questions right now. how do you do it? I think, you know, on one hand, it's somewhat easier for us to sort of envision a future because it's actually already how we're operating. You know, we have our conference and we have, you know, the typical membership offerings like most associations do, but we also have these, I call them pipeline programs, these programs that serve artists to build their capacity. We have the Advancing Indigenous Performance Program. We have PAD, which is, stands for Performing Arts Discovery, which is a, it's actually a program of the NEA that we administer on behalf of the NEA and the six regional arts organizations, which are all about lifting up artists. And in the, for these two programs, very specifically BIPOC and LGBTQI artists, right? So in other words, underserved artists are people who are typically not in the pipeline, who are not touring, or at least at the levels of support that they should be. So that is already happening at WA. So I think the question for us isn't about, well, how do we do it? It's actually, how do we make it all work under one umbrella? Hmm. How do we make our programs relevant to a membership? How do we make the membership and the conference relevant to these artists who, you know, and I think, and we're learning a lot from each other, right? Like, so really that's the challenge moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what WA does outside of those conferences? You've mentioned the pipeline programs, but what else are you doing for that? And then sort of as a, I guess maybe a precursor question being for those pipeline programs, do those artists need to be a member of WA to apply for that as well? Right. Or is that something that like, if you're in this geographic range or how does that work?
Yeah. So we have several programs. Like I mentioned, we have the Advancing Indigenous Performance Program. It's a national program. You do not have to be part of the Western States or provinces in order to apply. And you'll get this theme, which it really actually ties to who funds it. So that is a program that is funded by our partners at the Mellon Foundation and at Duke and at the NEA, and who are very clear that, and especially with the NEA, right, that we cannot put restrictions on that. Mm. Our PAD program similarly is funded by the NEA, but also the Department of Commerce, and we cannot put restrictions on having to be a member in order to participate in these programs. And so that sort of answers the question. It's very clear for us, right? And so we also administer the Jazz Road program on behalf of South Arts for the Western region. Mm. So, you know, we really are, even though we are a membership organization, we're in a lot of ways, we're a service organization, mm-hmm. you know, trying to get resources to artists in the communities whom they, you know, and who they serve. And all these different scales, you know, like I said, for AIP, that's the Advancing Indigenous Performance Program, you know, the chief activity is to support them in their career growth, set them up with mentors who can help guide them through this crazy industry that we're in, and showcase at our conference, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of overlap there. PAD, on the other hand, you know, through our work at the Department of Commerce, we orchestrate trade missions and we take delegations of artists to Western Europe, to Colombia, to Australia, in order to make those connections to promote U.S. artists abroad. Mm. And then there's Jazz Road, right, which is primarily a funding program. And so, you know, we're providing technical assistance in that grant application process, making sure that artists in the West know about the resource. So that is the bulk of the work that we do outside of the conference.
How much of your job is advocacy work? How much do you think you spend on that? And what does that look like for you?
That's a really good question. And that's a question I'm putting towards my board. Mm-hmm. You know, so I do have a background in advocacy. Mm-hmm. You have to really, if you're in the public sector. Yeah. I am learning more about the way that our membership, what we ask of our members, right? Mm-hmm. Of our membership associations like WA, like APAP, like ISPA. And it's interesting to find that advocacy really isn't part of the conversation. And I'm not saying it needs to be. You know, at WA, we really don't do advocacy. Mm. Where we're doing advocacy, I would say, is actually within the community. Gotcha. Right. Like for instance, our AIP program, mm-hmm. we're not only building up artists, but we're also building up the cultural competency of the presenters who are part of the network, mm-hmm. who will be hiring these artists so that they are welcoming these artists, not on like the presenter's terms, but really on, you know, the artist's terms and respecting their art forms, but also the context in which Indigenous artists do their work. That has been, I would say, the chief focus in the way that I think WA has approached advocacy in the past. Now, though, I think the lesson was very clear during COVID, right? We have to have a voice at the table, especially now that recovery funds have dried up. We're in a new environment. I think we have a lot of national funders who are changing their priorities, mm-hmm. with direct impacts. So who are these people who are going to speak on behalf of the ecosystem on behalf of the, and so we're figuring it out.
Going back to the conference, obviously you mentioned that, you know, a lot of people know you for the conference or sort of sometimes as the conference. There's a lot of benefits that we can talk about conferences for, like, you know, the agent side of people or in like the presenter side. Mm-hmm. But for a regional arts organization like yours, what is the benefit of having that conference for you?
What I hear from our members is trust, right? I mean, we know that in this game, we're not booking. Actually, some people are booking acts within the season that we're currently in.
Yeah.
It's crazy making, right? But that's just the nature of the post-COVID like performing arts world.
Yeah.
But really what we're talking about, we're talking a bit of a longer game. We're talking 2 years out, sometimes 3 years out. We're talking about artists who have ideas and who need investors. Mm. That doesn't happen online. That happens face-to-face. And so with WAW, right, I mean, you know, we all know that WAW begins the booking season and APAP sort of closes the booking season. You know, and there's you know, others on the periphery, but that's sort of the way it's understood. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for us, this is the first time that colleagues are seeing each other, you know, at least in 9 months since APAP. If they skipped APAP, that means it's been even a longer time mm-hmm. since they've seen, you know, their agent colleagues or other artists or even other presenters, right? At least in the West. And so I would say trust beyond anything else is the value for these convenings. And outside of that, you know, what's really interesting about the West that I don't think people appreciate as opposed to, let's say, you know, in the Mid-Atlantic, in the New York area, the East Coast at large, which is things are relatively close. You know,
yeah.
The West is almost as big as Europe, right? Our cities are not next to each other. Right. You cannot get on a train and within an hour being in another completely different and vibrant metropolis, right? You get on a train in LA to try to get to San Francisco, 9 hours later, maybe you'll get there.
Wow.
Right?
It's true.
I mean, it's faster to drive. Unfortunately, that's 5.5 hours, right? To get from Portland, from where I'm at, to San Francisco, that's 15-hour train ride. It's maybe 8 to 9 hours if you don't sleep, right? If you can like stay awake. So the nature of the West is that we are far apart.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whether it's WAW or whether it's any of our presenting consortia like California Presenters or Arizona Presenters, right? There is a lot of value in being able to come at one time, at one place. Mm-hmm. And it's not exactly to do business. Like I said, most people are doing business here at APAP.
Yeah.
But they're starting that conversation at WAW.
Right.
Yeah. And it sounds like it also gives you an opportunity to talk face-to-face with your constituents. Like, obviously, like, there's the business side of things. But for you, like, you get to hear the concerns.
Digging a little bit more into conferences. So we know each other, Josh, through the Presenters Leadership Consortium, which is a consortium of consortiums. Mm-hmm. So all the presenters consortiums from around the country get together on a regular basis to discuss running consortiums. And I've heard you talk a little bit about the elements of conferences and how in your experience they have changed or need to change moving forward post pandemic, because it's just a different world a little bit, like you've been talking about. So for you, what are the most important elements of a conference? What are things that you are seeing falling away, and what things do we need to really focus on moving forward as we continue to build out WAW, APAP, MAX, Arts Northwest? You know, we've all finally come back together and it's more consistent, but it's different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do I think about? I think about what's unique about being together, because my sense, and I can just talk from my personal view, right? I have a lot of demands on my time professionally, personally. And if I'm that way, you're that way. Mm-hmm. All of us are that way. I think what the pandemic taught us, or, you know, sort of reset us, is to be much more choosy about where we spend our time and with whom. And so what I'm thinking about when I think about our conference or any conference is, what's unique about that experience that I can only do in person? I'll be honest, I actually don't mind working from home. I'm really productive. I don't mind a Zoom meeting. Like, you know, if I have to sit in an auditorium and watch a video production, and that is the whole, right, or a slide deck, and hear someone talk, I would actually rather do it in my sweatpants at home, right? Where right. I can like go off camera and make myself some coffee, you know? It's not dissimilar to, I think, like the movie industry, where, I don't know about you all, but like every once in a while I will go out to the theater and always, you know, I talk to a friend, whoever I'm going with, about like, all right, so I think that would have been much better on Netflix. Like that was a couch movie.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I choose movies based on, you know, that I'm going to see in theater. Like, does it have something that's going to be added by having that surround sound feel? Like, is that going to add to it? But like, there's a lot of movies you're like, I don't really need to see this in there. I can watch this at home and get the full experience. So,
100%.
Yeah.
So that's the way I'm thinking about it. You know, I have one WAW conference under my belt in Seattle. I think it was relatively successful and it was fun. And now that I'm, you know, deeply thinking about San Diego, that's our next conference, which is going to be super wacky. It's going to be unique. It's going to be at a resort, right? Like big pool, lots of lawn space. And I'm like, why not? Like, what does it look like? What would it feel like, you know, to be a cruise director? And approach the conference that way, right? Because I know, instinctively know, because this is the way I am. At the last week of August in California, I'm gonna want to be outside.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I'm not gonna be alone in that. So, what does a conference look like? Perhaps.
I think you've touched on something really interesting. Is that what I love about that is like we are an industry that creates experiences, mm-hmm. and why not have your conference be an experience?
I attended the Association of Science and Technology Centers conference this past fall in Charlotte, North Carolina, as part of my work. And they have a big party at the Host Museum every year. And this was maybe the best party I've ever been to because you could experience the exhibits. They had food, they had drink, they had all sorts of experiential things for you to do. And then as you made your way through the museum, the room that you ended in was a lot of like hands-on, like putting ping pong balls and an air tube and watching him shoot out. So like really fun hands-on things for families, but they had a band in there with lots of space to move around and dance. And the experience of walking through the museum as an adult at night with all of these other elements was so much fun. It was, like I said, maybe the best party I've ever been to. But you are experiencing what another venue has to offer, right? And taking that in as well as just like enjoying yourself at the same time and, conversing with colleagues and taking that in. I'm going like, oh my gosh, how do I apply literally all of this to my own organization? And it was great. I've so enjoyed it.
Yeah. Now I've just got to figure out how to get my organization to fund me going to WAW. So
it sounds like a great time.
It's wild. Like these, and the folks are great, right? Like the conversations are wonderful. And this is what I've learned about WAW. I mean, it is a community, right? When I ask people like, give me what are the three words that you have to describe WAW? Community, always number one. It's usually like connections or equity soon thereafter. So yeah, I mean, are we a marketplace? Yes. Is it a booking conference? Yes. But there's just something about the Kool-Aid that over time, this group of people who have come together have figured out a way to transcend that.
Josh, I'd love to learn more about your work in government service and working at a variety of different government cultural agencies. So can you walk us through a little bit of your experience there? And what are the elements of working for a cultural agency for a city or a county government that are different than working for a nonprofit?
Sure. I knew nothing about public art. I knew nothing about arts administration in the municipal world until I was asked to sit on a public art panel. I used to work for a museum in Seattle's Chinatown, and the city was doing a project in our neighborhood. And so they tapped me. I sat on the panel. And so there I am, you know, in another museum, this beautiful space, sort of like looking at work, looking at artists, and we're talking about a budget of $600,000. And here I am working at a museum that if I had $60,000 for an exhibit, Jesus, like that would be the dream. Yeah. I mean, we're talking, right? Like shoestring budgets here. And I was like, what is this? Right? So then I explore more. I get on like the Seattle Arts Commission. And all of a sudden, this whole world opened up to me that was about policy, that was about creating an environment for the arts. And it just spoke to me. I'm like, yes, right? Because, you know, I mean, as a museum, but as a museum that was like sort of really intertwined with the neighborhood, we were doing great community-based work. And I had always wondered, I'm like, well, but what about the root problems that are creating the poverty in our neighborhood? Mm. How do we address that? Well, it turns out the Arts Commission, right? That's where that's at. That's where those conversations are happening. So was on the Arts Commission, and the first job, you know, to work at a local municipal government as an arts administrator that popped up, I applied. I don't know why they hired me, but they did. So I worked for the city of Redmond, which is a small town. You know, it's a suburb outside of Seattle, but is a big player because it's the headquarters of Microsoft. Yep. And it was such an interesting experiment. I mean, yes, an experiment, because it's this old suburb that, you know, like most, you know, outlying communities in the Western United States, super white, you know, families aging. And yet, because of Microsoft, was one of the most diverse communities in Washington State and one of the most diverse cities in America. There are 50,000 people wow. who live there, the 50,000 people who work there, right? And they were going through a transformation themselves because they knew that what the workers of Microsoft wanted, the future residents, is that they want something more urban. So you have this city that is, by its infrastructure, it was built as a farm town, then, you know, the layered on the suburb, and now it was trying to figure out, well, what does it mean to have an urban center? And I was in a parks department, so speaking of Parks and Rec,
yeah,
it is 100%. The first day, so I get hired by this guy, this parks director, whose vision was to integrate art into park design. I mean, this guy had, he showed me that he had a whole deck, he had a PowerPoint deck, and he's like, this is where I want to go. I mean, he's putting the bean on there, Anish Kapoor, and I'm like, sure, I could do that. Like, mm-hmm. that sounds like fun. I show up, my first day of work, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to strike the right balance between, like, casual, I'm in government, and like, but I'm the arts guy, you know, black jacket, black jeans, white collared shirt, black tie. It's a staff meeting for the Parks and Recreation Department. It is at the community center. It is in the workout room in which they had just bought, you know, 30 elliptical machines, and the meeting is taking place on the elliptical. We are doing a workout. This is my first day on the job. I am in my blazer, in my shirt and tie, my jeans, and boots that are not dissimilar to the ones I'm wearing right now, right? Like, they were not meant to be on, like, workout machinery. And so that was the beginning of my career in government. And I learned so much, right?
I feel like someone did you dirty on that one.
Oh, man.
I mean, I feel like a heads up.
Right?
Like, no. By the way, we'll
if
be
If you know Parks
this.
And Rec people, it's like sink or swim. They're just like, all right, constantly tested.
Here's the new guy.
Constantly tested. But, you know, I took off the jacket. I got on the machine. I barely made it through. But it was fun. And then after that, I worked for our neighboring city, Bellevue, which famously, right, is sort of where Amazon got its start. Amazon is now headquartered in downtown Seattle. While I was in Bellevue, however, if you remember when Amazon had that RFP
looking for their
H2Q, mm-hmm. and then, you know, New York got it, then they let it go. Where's H2Q now? Well, we don't talk about Bellevue, but is the city creating infrastructure for 24,000 new employees to come into the city over the next 5 to 10 years?
Wow.
Yes, it is. Mm. So it was just so fascinating, right? Going from Redmond, which is, it was building its city. I would imagine it felt like being in an old Roman, like, outpost, and a general decided to, you know, like, I mean, that's the story of all these, like, European mm-hmm. cities, right? Like, a general decided to retire. That's why they have an outdoor amphitheater. That's why they have a forum in the middle of France. It's like, why is this here? Right. Mm-hmm. This is not on a trade route. And that's what it was. Right. They bought land in the middle of the city. This is Redmond for a downtown park. Right. Like, this is their vision of what an urban experience was like. They had converted an old BNSF rail line that ran through the city into an urban park. And I got to be I got to find the artist to be part of the conversation about what is this space, right? And then in Bellevue, we're talking about something really similar. I mean, you know, there were more than a suburb, although that's really their roots, but it was a city built around the car. It also had a lot of problematic parts of it in which the key champion of anti-Japanese sentiment during World War II lived in that community. And that community in Bellevue actually used to be run by Japanese farmers. It used to be a farm town.
Wow.
They no longer were because of a family who's very powerful and owns most of the downtown there. And while I was there, right, confronting this past history through the arts, I mean, it was an incredible time to be part of these conversations and being part of communities who had a very different vision for themselves. But at the core of it, they knew art needed to be part of it, but they didn't know what. How many times do you have to integrate art as part of the DNA of a new city? So then that really was sort of my experience. And then from there, I went into county government. So there it is. That's my past work in government. And, you know, when you work in government, you're working at scale, you're working with budgets, and you're working with the explicit charge of improving your community, right? This isn't arts for art's sake. This is, how do we get kids exposed? How do we get access to people, whether they're elders or, you know, who are, you know, disabled, whatever it is. I mean, that is the charge of government. Like, that's why we are there. And at the same time, how do we make sure that our communities are competitive when places like Seattle, right, are becoming so expensive and cannot support the creative community anymore because it's through gentrification, mm-hmm. right? Like, what are the policies? What are the projects? What is the infrastructure that looks like? And so, and it's fun to me. I love that work. Mm-hmm. It's also, you know, you have to be in it for a very long time to actually see your work bear fruit.
So Josh, I don't know if you're aware, but the podcast has a time machine. So hey. Brian Zellmer somehow got his hands on a time machine, and we use it to take our guests back in time to a moment in their career and ask them this question. So I'm going to take you back to when you were actually a cultural anthropology student.
Okay.
What do you know now that you wish you had known then coming out of school with that degree?
I wish I'd known that there was this whole community of people who are invested in transformation of change making through the arts. I had no idea.
Follow up on that. Do you have any advice for, I mean, people in this community mm-hmm. to find more individuals like you? I mean, who are interested in that work, doesn't know that that work exists. I mean, is there anything that would have drawn you in sooner?
I see.
Like, super easy question. I mean, you know.
Right, right, right. I'll answer it this way, which is, you know, who do I see, who are the young people who I see now part of the conversation who are doing the work, who are basically interns, right? And they are folks who are coming out of these master's programs, right? I mean, we have actually institutionalized ourselves, right? So there are pathways now that, you know, we're only beginning to be built back in I graduated in 2001 from my undergraduate program. And I think we all, and I think we all instinctively know, right? If you're a grad student, you know, you are probably coming from some sort of place of privilege. Mm-hmm. And if you can afford to be an intern, right? Yeah. And so that's who I see right now, who are sort of that young generation who are sort of getting in at the ground level of their careers.
Yeah.
You know, where is it happening elsewhere? In Seattle, I would say that, you know, it was happening in restaurants. I mean, at the time, the number of like artist-led restaurants and co-ops in Seattle was sort of unique. You know, when I wanted to talk change, I actually didn't talk about it within the context of art, right? Like, I did leadership programs that were community-based. I mean, I can tell you how many leadership programs I've done, right? You know, my network is probably more robust in Seattle and within communities who are invested in social justice, in racial justice, than it is actually in the arts. And so maybe that's the advice, which is maybe it's not about, maybe the arts right now aren't the place to seek out collaborators, to seek out like-minded folks who are interested in art for change-making purposes. It probably exists at the local level. You probably, right? All politics are local. We know yes. this. Mm-hmm. You probably have to know what the conditions of your neighbors are first before you can apply the principles of art to those conditions.
Yeah. I love that. That's great advice. All right, last question. We've all been through a lot. We've come back. We're recording this at APAP 2024. What do you like most about working in the performing arts field today?
So I mentioned this earlier, that I am an after-school theater kid. There is something about entering into a theater. It happens to me every single time. I enter a theater and I just feel at home. I love walking into an empty theater because it reminds me of rehearsals. It reminds me of like the community that I grew up in, right? Fellow actors, fellow, like, the technician. I mean, just all of it. And I have to say, it's like being at home. That's what I love about it. I mean, do I love the performances? Of course I do. I love working with artists. Is it the quickest and the most efficient way for social change and transformation? Probably not. But it's my community. These are my people. And so I love it.
Excellent.
Josh, oh my gosh. I think we could talk for 2 or 3 more hours.
Easily.
There's so much I would love to dig in with you on. But we really appreciate your time today. It's been so wonderful having you on the pod. And yeah, I hope maybe you'll come back and talk to us again soon.
I would love that. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Kevin and Katie, thanks for sitting down with Josh and bringing him to the podcast. I've been fortunate enough to be in several meetings with him, and I've always been impressed with his ability to like come into the conversation and kind of flip ideas on their head and make me think about things in a different way. And I've always appreciated that about him, but I didn't really know him very well. And listening to him talk about the way he approaches his work, I really could relate to him, especially the part where he centers in the community approach rather than the curatorial. And I, you know, we talked about that earlier. That was just one part that I really enjoyed learning about him.
Yeah, Brian, I agree. It was super interesting to hear about all of his different ways that he approaches leadership and leadership in the role of previous institutions. The thing that really resonated with me was about him calling his approach to work as being a facilitator and, you know, helping the community tell their stories, helping the people around him kind of shine and do their best is an awesome way to think about leadership.
Yeah, I love that too.
Kevin had asked about the art of hula, and we talked a little bit about that. And the comment he made particularly about part of hula being good stewards of the land, I really did actually see a through line through the rest of our conversation and Josh's work. And I think this is maybe a perspective all of us should be thinking about as stewards of resources. I was really struck by that. And I think especially when we are thinking about community engagement, I was connecting that to something you said later about needing to know the conditions of your neighbors before you can apply principles of art to your community. I think there's a connection there. And so how are we individuals that run institutions or in leadership positions, how are we stewarding the resources available to us to impact others and being good stewards of that? And not being wasteful and really putting our money where our mouths are in terms of our mission statements, our value statements, the things that we want to try to achieve in our communities through the practice of visual art or performing arts or whatever that may be.
For substantial change within your community, the change really happens on a local level. And as a rural presenter, we're one of the only sources in our area. And in turn, that change is something that we feel like we have a chance to directly affect within a small community. And so I think that change happening on the local level, especially from an arts organization, is incredibly important.
Yeah, and that reminder too that no matter what your title is in an organization, if you're working in an arts organization, you're a leader in equity work. That's an easy thing to forget, but I love that reminder from Josh.
I really appreciated having the conversation with Josh, mostly because you can see that he leads through leadership by listening and not trying to dictate what is going to change and what is going to happen next, but really listening to the constituents and to the people who are members of WA. The other thing I thought was really interesting is, you know, not in this conversation, but being in meetings with him, just listening to the way that he truly is listening and then how he can take that and really like center it on the bigger picture and focus on, you know, centering those voices who are unable to be in the room, which I think is a true skill of his. And you can just tell that it's clearly a passion of his as well.
In a different direction, one thing that he said that I really loved was whenever you're looking at positions, pick your boss. Don't pick an organization, pick your boss, or in his stance, pick your board. And pick the people that you'll be working with directly, because that's going to be so important to your happiness and to your satisfaction with your work is the people that you're working directly with and surrounded by every day, especially for your own mental state.
Well, and your overall success.
I love that idea. But also thinking about it a little bit about how I could have done that in my own life. It almost seems like you have to be in a position of privilege to be able to have that choice, because sometimes many of us don't have that choice. You have a family you have to take care of and you're up against a financial crisis, and it's like you have this opportunity and you can take that or you can struggle and maybe find something else. But so I love the idea of it, but I just don't know that I've ever been in that kind of position. And it just sounds really like a really cool thing if you have that ability to do that.
No, Brian, I think that is also a valid point and a good thing to talk about. The other thing I think is on that similar line, I think we often forget as, you know, employees or as people like job seekers is that interview process is a two-way street. I mean, that you also have the opportunity to interview the people you are about to work for. And if you are in a position to not take a job or to wait for something new, like that is a good thing to think about.
The thing I would like to think about a lot more is if you were leading a conference and thinking about it as though you were a cruise director.
I love that.
What would that world look like? And I love this, like, I don't know, like reference to like improv and like theater making of like, if you exist in this world, then like what else is true? Sort of like just thinking about like being creative and, you know, rethinking the things that we just are like, well, this is the way that we do them. And I was just so excited to see where that conversation goes and like, what do these things look like? And I feel like in my own head, similar to you, Brian, like I walk the line of like, well, it's a privilege to go to a conference and like, you need to like make sure that you're doing work and doing the business the whole time. But, you know, at the same time, almost, here's a made up statistic, like 80% of the guests we've had have said something about like the people and the relationships in the industry or like what keeps them going and like their favorite thing. And so, you know, we have this like constant struggle, I think, like between all of us with like the qualitative and the quantitative. But yeah, like revisiting our conversation about like, what do conferences look like in the future? Like, I'm watching you, Wah.
I mean, the networking of the conference is the business. Like if you don't know the people, if you don't have those relationships, if you haven't built that trust, then you can't get the business done. The hang, the networking, all of the social aspects of the conference are the business.
Absolutely.
Josh's comment about when we were talking about advocacy and really how their advocacy work is about building the cultural competencies of presenters really struck a chord with me and made me think a lot about how much time do we actually have or want to have to put into understanding the art that we're presenting. And as we are diversifying what we're putting on our stages and bringing into our communities, how deeply as presenters do we actually understand the cultures and backgrounds and intentions of the artists. So it's something like I want to chew on more. And then he made two comments about collective vision versus singular vision for organizations and integrating art into the DNA of communities. And I think those two things go hand in hand, both for our organizations as we're, you know, doing strategic planning or mission planning or things like that, but then also how are we engaging in our communities more widely? And what an amazing thing to have the opportunity to create that DNA within our community and embed it so deeply that it's a held value. And it's something that our communities can really rally around. Just so many wonderful nuggets in this conversation. Josh, we thank you for coming and spending your time during the APAP conference with us. Kevin and I had such a great time sitting down with you. We had a great time discussing our conversation today. And we hope you all will join us the next time here on There's No Business Like.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening to There's No Business Like. Our producers and hosts are Brian Zelmer, Josh Benson, Kevin Maynard, Katie Miller, and me, Danielle Vanhoof. Views expressed in this podcast are ours alone and are not reflective of the organizations we are a part of. Keep up with us at nobusinesslike.com. There you'll find links to all of our episodes and socials. If you like this podcast, give us a like, a follow, a review, or our favorite, a 5-star rating. Oh, wait, what was that site? I got it. Don't worry. It is nobusinesslike.com. Do I sound out bus-I-ness every time I type it? Yep, sure do. Stay in touch, my friends.
In honor of that question, I am doing the rest of this interview with my shirt off, so.
What else is new? At least you have a reason this time.
Josh.
Oh, and I just want to quickly, I did fact check Danielle real quick, and I found in my book that she's correct. It says 80% of what Danielle said.
I think this statistic is 80% of what Danielle says is correct.
Oh, maybe yeah.
The reverse. I'm not sure.
You know, as far as being the cruise director, I do think now is a good time to let Joshua Heim know that No Business Like will come and lead their limbo contest. So whenever we're ready to have that discussion, the team's available.
Yeah, just we just need travel covered and we'll be there.
Yeah. We'll bring our own stick. So.